So, hi everybody. Welcome back to Wednesday night. Within the Spine's Potential, our final class. And for those of you online, I'm glad to know you're there. So, let's begin as we normally do by setting our motivation, our thanks and prayers together, and then we'll commence the class. But please just get comfortable in your seat. We'll try to make sure that your back is straight and your hands and your feet are comfortable. Allow your shoulders to relax and your head to be sitting just gently upon your neck. And you can keep your eyes open or close them. And do feel comfortable, just let your body breathe itself. And feeling the body breathe itself, just relax into that awareness. And imagine that the ground beneath you is made of a starry sapphire light. And all the space above you is filled with rainbows and offerings. And in the space above you, directly in front of you, is a throne. And on are cushions of a lotus, sun, and moon. And sitting on the moon seat is Buddha Shakyamuni. He is golden in colour. He's wearing three robes as a monk. His right hand is stretching down, touching the earth, while his left holds a begging bowl. Now, the Buddha is surrounded by an assembly of other enlightened beings. There are bodhisattvas and deities, and protectors and deities. And you are surrounded by all sentient beings. But please try to imagine your parents sitting beside you. Your father is at your right, and your mother at your left. Your friends and family are behind you. Difficult people are directly in front of you, and strangers surround these four groups of people. Kind of consider how fortunate you are to still be alive today. And to appreciate the leisure and opportunity you have to attain your spiritual goals. You have to act quickly though. These things are not quite right. This world does not exist as it seems to. And though this is the case, we have met a spiritual friend. And this friend is leading us in the safe direction of the three rare sublime ones: the Buddha as teacher or doctor, the Dharma as the teachings or medicine, and the Sangha as companions. So to make our offering of practice as purely as possible, imagine yourself to be as clear as a deity. You're holding a mantra in the right hand, a bell in your left hand, and they're crossed over your chest. And you're sitting within a sphere of great bliss. And from within the sphere of great enjoyment, you begin to lead all sentient beings in taking refuge and generating a mind of enlightenment. And so you say, I go for refuge as I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. In response to this prayer of yours, from the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectar stream down. And these dissolve into yourself and all living beings surrounding you. These lights and nectars purify negative karmas and obstructions. They increase your health and lifespan, along with your virtues and realizations. They cleanse with wisdom and fortify with compassionate love. Recollect the four immeasurable thoughts. Then decide to develop these yourself and to establish all beings in those four immeasurable states. Your firmness, join me in saying, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment to friends and hatred for enemies. The response is wish of yours. From the heart of each enlightened being, let some nectar stream down. And these dissolve into yourself and all living beings surrounding you. And negative karmas and obstructions are purified. Your health and lifespan, along with your virtues and realizations, are increased. And cleanse with wisdom, fortify with compassionate love, relax. From that relaxed state of awareness, invite the field for a kinetic merit. And in their company, you say, reverently, I am prostrated with my body, speech, and mind. I present vows of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions as related since the beginning of this time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of psychic interest and turn the wheel of Dharma from the beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the growth of enlightenment. So, to prevent ourselves from clinging to the merit we've created, imagine your body, speech, and mind, all of your enjoyments, the environment itself is utterly transformed into the pure land of the Buddha. The teacher is going to offer this to the Lama, your teacher, and the spiritual entourage. So you say, this ground, anointed with perfumes, during the flowers, the door knows me four continents of sun. I imagine this as a water field of it. My all living beings in the world's pure land. They've released the offering and the Buddha has accepted it with delight. Now he's looking down at you and you look up into his eyes. And in the eyes of the Buddha, you find immense humility, deep wisdom, kindness, and acceptance of yourself. And so, out of that gaze, you recollect renunciation, the bodhicitta, and the correct view. And from the heart of the Buddha, infinite light rays emanate, which in all environments and all beings, and everything dissolves into light, which dissolves into the Buddha. It begins to diminish in size, moves through space and enters your crown, descending down to your heart. So your mind and the mind of the Buddha become of one nature. Within that nature, you hear the mantra and you begin to recite it. Tata om mani mani, ma mani so ha. Now, from your heart, rays of light fill the 10 directions of space. Every sentient being abiding within space is utterly transformed into a fully awakened state. And so the two purposes are achieved. We acknowledge this meditation is one of imagination. It has imprinted the mind with the causes and conditions for actual enlightenment to take place. I think this evening you've made this life meaningful and you intend to engage in the study of the teachings of the Buddha, put them into practice as best you can, and develop the three principal aspects of the path and the two senses of tantra. Now breathing deep through your nostrils. Exhale. Let your mind, let your eyes flutter open and move your body back into waver. So this being the eighth class, we've covered a bit of material. Last time we spoke, the causes of the afflictions, we looked at those six and we sort of focused on ignorance at that time. The three root delusions being ignorance, desirous attachment, and attachment or greed. We also looked at how perceptions and conceptions work. And we also looked at the different categories of mental factor. These are basically, there are 50 ones, and the categories can be of many different types. We looked at the main minds, the six main minds, and then also continuities of mind. We looked at continuity of mind, we know that there are sort of gross, subtle, very subtle continuities. And the I or self of person is imputed to those continuities. This brings us to the 14th human rebirth. So we looked at that and of course what the basic nature of consciousness being clear and knowing. So today, we're carrying on from last week. So we're going to be looking at these six causes and how they produce the afflictions, what we can do about them. We're going to look at attachment and its abandonment, then anger and its abandonment, some of the differences in the practice lineages, and what the essence of any sort of spiritual transformation actually is. Now to use this book to bring about the material, I relied on material in these books here, and a couple of others. So you're aware of a new book that's come out, it's been out for maybe a few months now, a couple of months I suppose, called Vajrayana and the Culmination of the Path. Just so you might know about this book, written by His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Venerable Thupten Chodron. It's one of the in the series of this books called The Foundation of Buddhist Practice up there. It's the ninth book in that series. So there's going to come to a part here where I talk about the different practice lineages. If you want to actually know how this works, have a read it in that book. It really talks about how the methods of Tantra and how you actually transform the mind using those methods. So let's begin. So can anybody remember what, we know about six causes that bring about causes and afflictions. So what are the first three? I want to see everybody's just sort of hopefully you've got it in your head. What's
object,
the first three?
Object.
Seed, object, and
detrimental friends.
That's the fourth one. That's a good one, though. Detrimental friends, that's right. Familiarity, habits. But what's the other really big one?
Action.
It's inappropriate attention. How you pay attention to the object. So you exaggerate it in some way, or in way of art as well. So there are six causes that produce attachment. Of course, there is the seed. So that is the latent potential for the delusion of desirous attachment to arise from the mind. The objects for us that will produce attachment for us will be places, enjoyments, and bodies. These are the simplest ones. There are probably other things as well. The object, when it comes to inappropriate attention, here we're really, exaggerating the good qualities of that object. But how do we do that? Well, we focus on the object as if the good qualities are reified. In other words, they're coming from the object itself, having very little, nothing to do with our consciousness. And the object only appears good to you at that time. So we have familiarity. We are familiar with this disturbing emotion. We do it a lot of times. So we have this ingrained mental habit. We do look at things, it does appear to us as if the object itself is good, and the good qualities are coming from the object. And also notice that when we do this, the bad qualities never appear, only the good. So it takes a different sort of mind to move it off, you know. So this could be like the company we keep, the influence of others. Yeah. And finally, the bad habit. The actions that strengthen the delusion. So if you find yourself doing this a lot, what we hope for is over time, once you know that your mind is doing this, and what you should do really, is check it out to see if your mind is doing it. When you look at something good, is the bad appearing then? You know, like a white, it doesn't. When you're looking at the good, is it the case that only the good appears then? And it is. So, you know, okay, that's all correct, right? So have some sort of trust in the teaching. It's not, you know, I'm actually checking it out. That is actually what's happening. Does the good seem to be coming from like over there? Then I've gone along with that. We've gone along with this for a long time, right? And that's, so we've got a habit of doing that. But once you know that that's impossible, then you have to start breaking your habit. So basically, six causes fuel our disturbing emotions and create the suffering. And this question is about how does attachment function to disrupt our lives? So we know desirous attachment is a deluded mental factor. It observes a person, object, idea, or place, and exaggerates its good qualities, and sees it as a source of true happiness. So how does that function to disrupt our life, any idea?
Distortion.
Yeah, there's a distortion there. And what does the distortion do? How does it affect us? What's our response to this distortion?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it encourages us down this path, and so with that encouragement, what do we do? Yeah, before we suffer, what do?
Grasp.
Yeah, we react, we grasp. We actually go after these objects. We want the objects. So if you don't go after them, then there's a sense of dissatisfaction. Even when you get them, there's a sense of dissatisfaction. Because it's not giving you what you expected it to give you. So what this does, it creates a constant cycle of craving and dissatisfaction. So if you do go after the object, and if you get it, so the craving is like the getting it, all the stuff you do to get it. Now you've got it, it's not as good as you expected it to be. So now you want something different, or more, better. Ben?
I was just thinking that thing that Rabina Corton says, we're all junkies. In that sense of being like, the addictiveness and going after the hits.
Yes, if you ever have the habit of being a junkie or you know, involved in some sort of thing, you'll know. But, you know, it's just like this. I just think of one time, you know, so this is before I was a Buddhist. So I remember looking at the gear on the table, you know, and telling myself all the bad things are going to happen when I use this gear. And meanwhile, I'm saying all that, but you already use it. And then I use it. It's kind of like, man, that's crazy. You know all about it, but you're going to do it anyway. And of course, tomorrow you'll do the same.
Yeah, all those promising, this is the last time.
But it's even more subtle, though, in terms of people buying the next model of a car, getting a bigger house, constantly, never enough, you know.
That's right. Satisfaction.
Happiness is out there.
Yeah, that's the great fault. That's the fault. That's the fault. The big thing is that. That's where what's the root of it. Yeah, happiness is an object. In fact, yeah, objects can bring us happiness, things external to us. Seeking, hoping that we'll be happy with it. So it's not, the faults here are not what we desire, but of the mind's habit of clinging to them and reifying them, making them better than what they are. Now, there's no fault in like wanting to be married or to have a house or a car or a career. That's not the thing. Something about that, what's the mind doing with that object? How do you stop it? There are two stages here. You can lessen or diminish your own attachment to objects, and then you can actually stop them altogether. One is much more easier than the other. The first one's easier, right? We diminish it or lessen it. So you can go through, well, I'll show you here. So the first one is you just contemplate the faults. Believe me, this will take you, it'll take more than once. Because I can sit there and look at that and tell them all the faults and still go ahead and do it. So once is not enough. You've actually sort of got to get it in here somewhere deep enough where it affects you.
Because often what you do is you know faults,
yeah,
but you go, oh, they're not really that bad. Well, you start compromising.
Yeah, that's right. So to listen temporarily, you contemplate the faults of what we desire. And one of the ways of contemplating these faults is to always reflect on its impermanence, its changeable nature. So there's that, and then you've got to ask yourself, will this object bring me lasting satisfaction? Will I always be satisfied with this object? And your answer to yourself will probably be no, I think. You just look back over your life and go, well, was I satisfied? Well, I was. Was I? And then you go, no, what's the difference? What's changed in your life? This object is what I'm, this is going to do it to me.
Sometimes the desire for the object is so strong, you don't care if it lasts. No, I just right. want it yeah, now.
That's exactly right.
I don't
that's
care right. if it's not going to last no, forever.
That's right. Yep, that's right. And so then, of course, once you have it, you don't care, then it goes, then you want it again, or another one just like it. And so this is the cycle of cravings that it creates. Yes, Ben?
I was just noticing how you get really elaborate with the way you create, like you get sort of smart about it and go, if I only go out for breakfast once every 2 weeks, it'll still feel really special. But the minute you start going out every day, it's like no big deal.
Yeah, that's right.
And if you manage, like, how often you do something, you can still get your hit. It seems really good.
Yeah, well, I sort of try and do it that way. As I know, that's like the thing. You really could gauge your object attachment, the pleasure diminishes, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Just, you know, get your head. So you go, okay, well, I'm not doing that. I know that. So I'll just do once a week.
Yeah.
And I can appreciate the object. Doesn't mean, you can take a different stance towards it in your mind. You can just say, I just appreciate, I know it's impermanent and so forth. Just like our lives, but we should appreciate them, shouldn't we? Can still make good use of your life, even though it's impermanent. Just like the objects.
But are you still being involved in attachment just in a more
sneaky way? So you ask yourself, am I overestimating? Do I really think all the enjoyments are coming from there? That's why I'm going to do it once a week.
You have an understanding that it's relative. Like, if you did it all the time, it would lose its special.
Yeah, that's why you don't, isn't it? Yeah. So you're not going to do it all the time. So you've already knocked that one on the head, and then you're going to go, okay, now, so I am engaging with it. But how? Because again, it's not the object. It's how I'm engaging with it. So these are the two major ways of working against attachment. Of course, there's many other ways too, depending upon what the objects are that you have attachment towards. And in Aria Davis 400, that's got a really great chapter on overcoming attachment to the human body. You know, the arguments and the things I thought, I just crack up laughing, I do. And it's got really good points, you know, just going, oh yeah, and of course, yeah, you know, he knows how we think. You know, and he sort of makes a bit of fun of it. You know, when you look at it, you go, oh, yeah, that's right.
I think
Eddie
also sometimes you need to change the people that you spend time with.
Oh, yeah.
Because often they are the ones that are...
Yeah, yeah. This is one of, like you said, this is one of the causes.
Yeah.
The company you keep, they can really keep you going. Yeah, I've got an object of attachment, or any object, right? You can, like I said, I have a big attachment here to apple pies. There's nothing white cream on it. Right? So every day, I'd be, as soon as I reached the fridge, I was up there, get my pie. You know, one day, like I know this, I know I've got attachment to these pies, and I'm watching them, I just look at the cream, and I've got all this imagination of what, oh, it's going to, you know, amazing, amazing. Except it's not. It's much more amazing in my mind than it is in my mouth. And that's what you can discover if you eat it slowly. Like, whatever the objects of your attachment are, you have to engage with it. Like, what's the nature of this object? Is it actually as good as it appears to me? Like I said, when I was eating it, like the pastry seemed to be like cardboard when I was actually paying attention. And the cream, I don't know what that was. You know, so when you do this, you find out how much you're projecting onto it. So this is another way of, like you can do the false. This sort of thing, like, you know, you're really paying attention to, like, what is it about this object that's so great? And then you're not going to find what you think is there. Again, it's like I said, what we've done is we've ratified the qualities, we've pushed them out there. Now it's in my mouth, now I'm looking for it there. It's not there. So you find this with most any of these objects, if you could just sort of, pay attention to it. But proper, you know, not for some inappropriate attention, but proper attention. Looking for its, you know, discovery. Like, the qualities are there, I should be experiencing them. But often you find you don't. Yeah, and the other side of that too is like the great joy, isn't it? Because I find it's like, you know, guess what? You just created it all.
Right.
So now, okay. Like you said, don't stop imagining these apple pies to be so great, or women, or money, or something else, right? Use your mind to create some other greatness like this. Think about it sort of like different, like apple pies, I guess, it's like full of sugar and cream and fat and all that sort of stuff. You could say, this is by engaging them, like I'm actually putting on some body mass that helps them to mix. Enjoying food, because you're meant to be able to do that, isn't it? We have to eat. But we don't have to be attached to the food, but we can eat and have the idea of food being a thing that keeps us alive and gives us energy to engage in our spiritual path. It's the same with the body, isn't it? When you actually look at the body, you can have aversion towards the body. In fact, it's one of the ways of overcoming attachment to the body. Right? Just look at all the gross stuff about the body. So you go, okay, yep, so that's true, so what? You say, well, you better look after it. It's the only one you got. And you're going to need it to become enlightened. It's in fact, the human body is the best body you can ever have to become enlightened. Right? So you don't have attachment to it, but it's got great utility. You can appreciate it and say you use it correctly. Now, most of the verses I've got to illustrate this talk to, I've come from a text called 37 Practices of Bodhisattvas. And I particularly like this one because I thought it was so very true. Like I said, the last thing for all to actually stop attachment, you have to send these meditations. Interest of oneself, the object, and the activity, and the results, they're all dependent arisings, existing in mere name. But I like this. So sensual pleasures are like salt water. The more you partake of them, the more your craving will increase. Therefore, when something arouses attachment, to abandon it immediately is the practice of a bodhisattva. So to abandon it, I mean, what do you think that it is?
Attachment.
It's attachment. It doesn't have to be the optic. The optics are quite useful, valuable, get the pen to rise and so forth. Attachment's the problem, it's the mental thing that's engaged with us. And I love this idea, salt central pressure like salt water. You can never imagine, like, the ship going down, you're out in the salt in the boat, and there's salt water all around you, right? And you drink some, but it never quenches your thirst. You have to have some more, you have to have some more. And then you get sick and hallucinate. Well, isn't that the way it is with the objects of attachment? Is that a question?
Just such a good feeling.
It's so bad, why it's so good.
That's possible.
Yeah, I can say. So remember here, so I'm going to read this is all in the context of a Buddhist path.
Yeah.
The goal here is to be liberated. So this is why they have these particular ways of looking at bodies in these ways. Yeah, so of course, what the thing is that you have a feeling arises. So when you engage with the object, in whatever way, you make contact with the object, a feeling will arise. If it's pleasant and the grasping comes, then attachment's going to fall. It's there you have the spirit of the attachment right there.
Is the trick just to like feel pleasure and not get
more? Yeah, you have to cling to it. Yeah, that's just the energy. You can feel it, and then you don't have to. Most objects of attachment, you want to possess them. You don't have to. You can just appreciate it. You can have the feelings. You can't escape feelings. There's nothing wrong with a feeling. It's clinging to the feeling. Then you cling to this feeling, and you immediately think it's the object. Right? Object's giving me this feeling. Trying to engage with the object more often to keep this feeling. But anybody who's known about these good feelings you have with bad objects, if you keep doing it, guess what happens?
Doesn't turn so well.
That's right. The good feelings become bad feelings. They don't feel pleasant anymore. That's this other thing. If the actual object would give us what we wanted, you think. The more we engage with it, the better we feel, the happier we become. But in fact, that's not the case. In fact, it's the opposite. So I read a story with Austin's billionaires. How much more money do you think you need to be happy? You know what the answer was? That was about $100 million more dollars. Richest man in the world. Only just a little more. So one of the things, so what's most interesting is its disguise. Like this is insane, Ben. It's so bad, why do I feel so good? So unlike anger, which feels painful, desirous attachment masquerades as a path to happiness. It's a clever saboteur that promises fulfillment while functioning to create a constant cycle of dissatisfaction and restlessness. This makes it incredibly difficult to recognize as a problem. Also fascinating is its subtlety. It's not just about craving material things. Attachment extends to our reputation, our opinions, and even our spiritual progress. This deluded mental factor functions as a root of other afflictions. When our attachment is frustrated, we get angry. When it's threatened, we get jealous. The ultimate antidote isn't simply renouncing objects, but realizing the emptiness of the self that craves and the perfect object it desires. And this removes the very basis for the mind to cling. The two ways, you could either examine the object or you could examine the me who desires that object. Where is this me? So those two are for the short term.
Yeah.
Right? The false and the impermanence.
And they work very well with things that you know are really bad for you. You know, like
I think women are quite nice for me. I think women are quite good for me, but I still do the false. They're not that good. They are good. So object external things are quite easy to work with. So you have to remember, it's not the object that's the problem.
No.
It's the attachment. That's how our mind is apprehending that object. So we've got to keep talking about the object so the mind will realize, oh, it's not that great. So when you do this sort of thing, like contemplate the false, you're contemplating the false of attachment. Attachment is the faulty thing, not the object. So why is it faulty? What's wrong with this? Yeah, well, I'm overestimating the good qualities. I think they're always good. I think they're only good. I think they're over there. That's the thing. Well, is it? We have to have, well, you know, so I don't know. I have a look. And then you go to say, no, of course the object doesn't exist like that at all. So the mind, the fault is this mind of attachment. I just use women as an example. So I look at the woman, I think she's wonderful. She only appears wonderful, only wonderful. I'd like her. Not to spend some time with her and so forth. So when I say I'd like to spend some time with her, what am I expecting? A good time. This is a good object. So then you can question this type of mind. And you'll find this mind is wrong. What it thinks is there is not there. This is not the fault of the object, because the object doesn't have it in the first place. So there's two things here, right? One is, or three actually. There's mind, and the mind is impermanent. It's subject to change. The objects are also subject to change. And there's emptiness. It's complete dependent arising. And so you go, okay, so now I've got these objects, and I've got this mind, and this mind is over-exaggerating the good qualities of the object. You might not know that, but as a Buddhist, as a person who's coming to classes, you should be able to say, geez, I'm looking at her as if she's great. That's an exaggeration. So that's got to be the mind of attachment. Not only that, if she turned around and grinned at me and she had no teeth in her mouth, I'd quickly change my mind into, she's not so great after all. And then that's my mind that changed. That's impermanence. And then, of course, is the emptiness of oneself, one's mind. And emptiness is a big one. It'll be good. We can get to that. Other ways are, like I said, these other ways. But it comes back to the mind. It's not, you shouldn't really have a problem with the objects. Let's do our first meditation. What time do you finish? Half eight, is it? Okay. Six. Yeah, we're not six. Let's start talking or one, we've got another. Please, so get comfortable in your seat. And bring your awareness to the natural rhythm of your breath. So feel the breath and then relax into the awareness. So now we want to set our intention to understand the pattern of desirous attachment altruistically. We're doing it not just for ourselves, but to engage with others and to help them understand the nature of attachment in their mind. Why? To be able to stay in a sense of peace. So let us gently bring to mind something you have recently wanted. An object, praise, an experience, just something. You have the object. Now, desirous attachment is a habit that exaggerates an object's positive qualities. Believes the object holds a key to our happiness. Now, this cycle of seeking outside ourselves disrupts our inner peace. It leaves us in a state of restless craving. Like drinking salt water to quench thirst, attachment promises satisfaction, but only increases craving and leaves us wanting more. So why does the cycle of craving, grasping, attachment feel so disruptive, even when we succeed? And the nature of attachment is agitation. Attachment ties our peace to fleeting things and creates anxiety and fear of loss. So how has your mind justified this craving? Framing it as a sort of a harmless wish. So our mind often disguises the urge of attachment as a reasonable goal. It overlooks the peace it costs. So knowing this, how can you meet a strong desire with more wisdom? How can we meet a strong desire, desirous attachment with more wisdom? Very simply, by noticing the craving as a mental event. By noticing craving as a mental event, we create a space of awareness before acting. So decide to notice this grasping from this evening onwards. Try to greet it with awareness instead of judgment. And carry any insights you have about attachment with you. Know that true contentment is a quality that you can always cultivate. And breathe in through your nostrils. Exhale. So now we're going to talk about anger. So anger, of course, we have the seed. This just means we all have a potential within ourselves to become angry. That's the seed of anger. The latent potential for anger in the mind. Now the seed has, we have to meet an object. And it could be anyone or anything. And it could include your friends. So you get angry that the floor is made of wood and not concrete. You get angry because your friend is wearing a shirt just like you. Angry at the computer because it's not doing what you expected. So many objects, basically anything. The fact that people have got enlightened, got angry at the Buddha. So you get angry at an enlightened person too. Object inappropriate attention. So what do you think the inappropriate attention does here in case in anger? This is actually worse than our experience in the end, or
our view of
the object itself. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, its qualities are seen to be all bad. And of course, when you look at these objects, the good does not come through at that time. So remember, it's not necessarily the good of the object, but your mind cannot apprehend any good qualities of the object. It can only apprehend the bad. So we focus on this object in an unhelpful way. Yeah, so when people get angry at us, don't we? And we get angry at other people. So in the Buddhist training to stop that anger, What's one of the first practices they do, if anybody remember?
Patience.
Yes, that is one of the practices of against anger. You need to do this. In terms of six causes and one effect, what's the first thing we'll do?
Everyone's been one mother.
That's right. So when you're looking at the objects I'm looking at you and anger arises to, I go, oh, Deb's been my mum, or the cockroach has been my mum. And when I remember my mum, I remember the kindness of my mother. So you might not have kindness to your natural mum. You have to check up, right? If you don't naturally have that, still there are ways of thinking about that kindness. Just the fact that you brought you into the world, that you're here. That was a really great thing that you did. And so that immediately, so that's the way, another way of sort of interrupting this seeing only the bad qualities. So I can see this one does, it exaggerates the bad qualities. If somebody speaks in a way we don't like, or is wearing something we don't like, whatever it is that creates the animosity. If it's a human being, you need to tell yourself pretty quickly, this woman or this man, whoever it is, was once my mother. And when they were really kind to me. So now you get a chance, right? So now you get a chance to bring in some kindness rather than just see what this is all unpleasant qualities. That's why I'm sort of shifting it. Yeah, this is really tricky. Really, like I said, we just have this big habit of looking outwardly at the things and thinking that these objects are the things that are making me happy and unhappy, but they're not. And that's the thing. They contribute. The major cause is one's own ignorance and afflictive emotions. That's the thing that really makes you unhappy or happy. It's the mind. Anger can be, for sure.
There's a basic fear there, then, you know,
could strike out.
Anger to reject it.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you could look at the object, it gets so bad that I have to attack it.
Mm-hmm.
Is this going to attack me or something? You know, you'll come up with plenty of reasons, but you act on them. Now, these objects that you can get angry towards, you develop this familiarity towards anger. And this has come about through helping your... there's nine groups of different people here. So I put this one up because you can become angry at people who have helped your enemies. So you often get angry at those who are trying to hurt you in the past, present, or future. That's you can actually become angry. You become angry at those who have hurt yourself in the past, are hurting you now in the present, or might hurt you in the future. So you can have anger towards them. Another group of people is those who hurt your family and friends, the people you care about. You can be like a whole group, like the Palestinians, right? You can, any group of people that hurts another group of people that you care about, you can become angry at that. They could harm those people in the past, the present, and they could harm them tomorrow. So you could be upset about that. So there's 1, 2, 3, 6 groups of people. Now comes the other one, those who have helped your enemies in the past, the present, or the future. You become angry at them. And so, of course, then you just develop a habit of doing that. They're the objects.
A lot of people.
Yeah, that's right. That shows a lot of people being easy to do. You're becoming distracted and, of course, falling under the influence of others, the company we keep. Yeah, so you know this is a common thing that people in politics do. They single out one group of people and they try to get another group of people to attack them. Well, they look at one group and say, this is our problem. We've got to get rid of this problem. And lots of people fall for it. And in terms of the bad habits, well, the bad habits we've done in the past that we keep doing now, and if we don't stop, ones we'll do in the future as well. Now, understanding these ways of sticking up like this, these six like this, and the other six before, What I hope for you to see is that our suffering is not random, but it's got identifiable causes. These are all causes for our suffering. But this is the fact that we have a potential to suffer. It's right there. But then we meet up with objects. We are like, we have an awareness called the subject. It engages with an object. That object could be a cause for us to get cranky. It's not the main cause, of course. It's a contributory cause. Main cause is that seed. That's the main cause. And of course, we engage with these qualities because we're actually ignorant of how they actually exist, and objects all appear reified to us. The qualities that we impute now seem to be coming from the object itself. And of course, whenever we do it, it's you cannot get, like you can't see an object to be black and white at the same time. It's one or the other. It's good or it's bad. But that sort of the dualism, we can't hold the two truths at once, one at a time here. So if we see, and you can try this out, just get an object, look at it, just ask yourself, well, how are you feeling about this object? And you've got three, you've only got three choices here, right? You either like it, you don't like it, or you're neutral. Now, whatever you'd say it's a neutral, right? You just locked out the other two. They have not appealed to you.
But what about when you like some things about it, but not others?
Yeah, and so there's two different things, one at a time, isn't it? It's one at a time. It's always one at a time. And so again, this is where this idea of dependent arising comes. It's about to free us up from that way we naturally behave and think. Dependent arising loosens everything up. And anger disrupts our life. Of course, this picture might not be so clear, but it was taken in a courtroom, and this man leaping over is the prisoner, and he's attacking the guard. And we go over the top. And I just put up, this is what I like what Holiness said about anger, the worst thing, and I'm in agreement. You lose your ability to reason. You can't actually think. Your mind get hijacked. Yeah, so under the influence of anger, we lose our reason and act in ways we may regret. And of course, one of the great things that anger does is damage relationships. If you've ever been in the face of somebody who's angry, I always say unforgettable. You get to see an aspect of somebody that's not present, don't you? And even when people say, I'm sorry, like, yeah, okay, great, you're sorry, but I can't forget what you just did. And from a Buddhist perspective, you go, and so what does that tell me? So I should not forget. What I should not forget is this person is under the control of a delusion. It's not that they're angry, bad people. It's they're under the control of delusion, so they don't have power. They've actually lost their ability to reason. Which is more of a great, from our side, to inspire more compassion, isn't it, and care. Go, oh, you poor dear. But of course, that's not the way we often look at it, is it? Yes, I've got to get away from you as soon as possible, mate.
The thing that makes me so angry about anger is that I get angry at myself and feel so bad that I've been angry. And he said, it's like this. Being on a wheel.
Yeah, well, that's right. That person is insightful.
How's that
just a great sense of So anger destroys our peace and positive energy. And always the problem is not the object. Again, you've got to come back to the mind, right? It's not the person or the entity or whatever it is that annoys. It's the anger that arises in our own mind. That is the problem. A practical thing, what's a practical thing you can do? If you're aware enough, so before anger arises, what has to happen? Before you get angry, you have to have a feeling that is unpleasant, uncomfortable. You don't want this feeling. This anger, this feeling, this uncomfortable, unpleasant feeling Has arisen because of, then, why has it arisen? Because of, in 12 minutes. This is how you've made contact with an object. And the appropriate attention is in here with the contact. And this feeling arises, and it's unpleasant. And then I don't like it. I don't want it. It feels yucky. It feels bad. You don't feel good. You're not neutral anymore, and you don't feel good. Our natural thing is to think it's the object. But it's the mind. So what can we do to not respond unfavorably towards this unpleasant object? What do you think? What's the first thing, simplest thing we could do?
Breathe.
Thank you, Madonna. That's right, breathe. Take a breath. Because you feel this, right? It's unpleasant. You're feeling it. And often what you do is you hold your breath. It's like, no more. I'm not breathing anymore. You know, when things go, let it out. Yeah, that's right. It actually works because, you know, we know that mind and body are highly interdependent. One affects the other. So I found that find simple things you can do here. Often the simplest things are physical things. And like I said, when you already feel bad, it's really hard to sort of flip it into the positive. You know, you sort of have to get a neutral state, then go to the positive state. But that takes mental work, and that's hard when it feels terrible, when you feel terrible. So then do the simple thing, breathe. Or change your posture immediately. Do something physical and simple. And then that gives you mental space. Then you get a break from the unpleasant feeling. They've got a little gap there now. Now you can sort of challenge it. Remember, it's not the object, it's your own mind. So it's justified that you hurt yourself. It's justified that you hurt yourself. That's what you just said to me. So the impact is one of unpleasantness. Right? You have the impact on you is one of it's unpleasant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right. So what to do? Simply enough is just taking three breaths. Yeah. So it always comes back to us, right? This is the thing. I mean, from a Buddhist perspective, we say that the problem is really, if you look at why do I feel this way, you go, I've got the seed, I've got the potential within me to feel this way. Now I'm feeling this way. How come? Like contact with this object, and my attention is inappropriate towards the object. So now I feel this way. Now, what am I to do? I know. I'll get angry. We don't think like that, do we? We just get angry. Right. So it's in that gap. You know, this is the thing. We're not trying to change our way of being in the world by changing the world first. Now I feel better. Now I'm okay again. I mean, people have been trying to do this for centuries. They've got very far. Stopping anger again is the same idea. We can practice patience. So that's the first thing. It's like, don't respond in the same way. Don't let your anger go out. Don't let it come out of your mouth and through your body. You remember that it is impermanent, right? And there are lots of faults about anger. So one of the things about anger is you can always be sure of this. It's going to hurt you. That's for certain.
Is it? I got down and I was like, I lost it when they told me something. I just swore. Like, I've never had an explosion like that. And I just ran up to it. Mm-hmm. But I realised I knew the karmic aspect of what I'd done. Like, there'd be bad, this is a bad result. But in the moment, right, actually felt really good. And I've never been angry for a long time. So can that happen? Can you immediately feel a relief?
There's a relief there, but is that anger?
Well, I swore at this person on the phone and yelled at them and stuff, so
yeah.
I think it was. But no, I swore at this.
No, I've had a thing like this myself, then. The experience is very similar to this one. I had to stop immediately doing what I was saying.
Right.
See, oh my God, no wonder people like this.
Yeah, there's a feeling of power, isn't there,
yes,
sometimes?
Well, for me, it was a real, because I've been doing this for 2 weeks, getting back, like, ringing them up with the same problem every day, banging around five departments.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's,
I mean, the problem with that is you're habituating
yourself to the paper and you're right. But sometimes we have things where you go in and get short-term relief, long-term suffering.
Right. Yeah.
Sometimes it's short-term suffering and long-term suffering.
Yeah. Because I know the karmic aspect of it. I'm crazy.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing is, poor person that you raged at,
right,
was it that person's fault?
I apologised to them later, and they said, I understand where you're coming from. Like,
yeah,
you know, I would be as frustrated as you. I would start just saying.
Yeah, yeah. Yep, that's right.
You're basically saying bad stuff can happen, but just don't get angry at that.
Yeah, that's right. Because when the bad stuff happens, from a Buddhist perspective, what should we do to explain the bad stuff that happens to us?
Be thankful that that karma has been burned.
Yeah, that's like, what's the effect of karma, of course. I can only have this effect, not present the causes. So, yeah, no need to get upset. It's, you know, just come back home. Patience, the faults, recollect compassion, and again, wisdom, realizing emptiness is the one that really crashes it on its head. So you've got temporary solutions and a long-term solution. One of the books I put up there was a book referring to as a commentary on the patience chapter in Shanti Deva's Way of the Bodhisattva. So in that book, and then again, the Venerable Thupten Jodrin's book, talking about anger, man, there's so many great solutions in there. So many cases of when somebody does this to you, and you know, fire up and go, this is what you can do instead. This is what you can do instead. Yeah, well, that's a great way of reasoning, isn't it? That I do that with you. So one of the reasons, so if somebody hits you and you get angry, who are you blaming? And they say, well, the person who hit the stick. So, okay. So the person is being held under the grip of anger. So who should you blame? The person or who's holding the person? It's got to be anger, doesn't it? Now you blame the person for holding the stick, even though it was the stick that actually touched you. You blame the person and go, okay, but now you understand the person themselves is being held on is in the grip of anger. They're being held themselves. So who's to blame them? If we go to anger. So where's anger coming from? And you go ignorance. There's the major one. That's the fault. It's the fault of ignorance.
Something that works for me more is about understanding that if I react now, I will cause, you know, in terms of karma, right? I will cause something very similar to happen in the future.
Yeah, for yourself.
Just the other way.
That's right.
And so it's kind of like I'm so tired.
That's right.
I'm so tired of the hamster wheel.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's true. That's
I'm just tired.
That's right. That's. Yeah, you gotta get that. Well, I'm tired. That's right.
I'm tired, man.
So, again, from Bodhisattva's 37 practices, if you've not pacified the enemy of your own anger, combating outer opponents will only make them multiply. Therefore, with the army of love and kindness and compassion, to tame your own mind is the practice of the Bodhisattva. Yeah, so again, it's this inner practice. It's coming back and going, what's actually doing the harm here? Finding the correct object to put your attention on. And here it's anger itself. That's the culprit. And, I'll tell you the story again. You can ask stories. You can ask yourself, from whence does anger arise? When does it arise for you? When do you get angry?
Oh, shoots. It should be like this. It's not.
Yeah, so I agree with you. In fact, Shanti Deva says in Bodhisattva's Way of Life, the fuel of anger is in not getting what you want.
Oh.
That's what he says. And that's why, just check. That's what it is. And then you find, oh my God, that's a habit of mine. When I don't get what I want, I get cranky.
Barely.
Of course you can get cranky for lots of reasons.
You're getting what you want.
Yes, yeah, so I want them to be treated fairly. That's not happening. I'm upset. Yeah. So that's a good check, you know. So again, from your side, our side. So again, so what's most interesting about anger is how it functions as a master of disguise. It presents itself as a powerful protector, a justified response to injustice, and a source of strength. However, from a Buddhist view, this is a complete delusion. Anger's true function is to destroy our own happiness and peace. It's a profound act of self-sabotage that feels like a weapon aimed outward, but is a poison we drink ourselves. Another fascinating aspect is that it's not seen as a random, uncontrollable force, but as a cognitive error. But anger only arises when we focus on an object and exaggerate its negative qualities through the lens of inappropriate attention. This means anger isn't a fundamental part of who we are. It's a correctable mistake in our perception. The ultimate solution, therefore, isn't to suppress anger, but to uproot the mistaken view of self that it's trying to protect. Like we said, I'm not getting what I want. And anger is trying to protect that. A false view. Okay, let's meditate. You're sitting comfortably, shoulders relaxed and the back is straight. You're letting your body breathe itself. And you're going to do this meditation for the benefit of ourselves and others. So you don't harshly judge or suppress feelings, but understand them. So first of all, bring to mind a recent moment of mild irritation. And you have to observe it like a scientist, with a gentle curiosity, noticing the story and the feeling. Now, the primary function of anger is to destroy your peace of mind. Is that what the story and the feeling are doing? Because anger is like a fire that starts by trying to burn something outside, but ends up consuming the house, your own mind, from within. So what is this emotion? Anger, which feels so protective, ultimately harm our own well-being. What is anger, which feels so protective, harm our own well-being? The answer is because its nature is exaggeration. It fixates on the negative. It distorts our perception and destroys our capacity for clear thought. So when is your own mind mistaking the inner fire of anger as a shield of protective warmth? So the mind often believes that the turbulent energy of anger is strength. But this energy is a restless fire that burns your own peace. It's not a steady warmth that brings comfort. So knowing this, how could you relate to anger differently when it arises in your own life? try to recognize anger not as a protector, but as a deluded visitor. Choose not to serve it. Allow it to go out on its own. Let's try to carry this wisdom with you throughout the evening and the next few days. Exhale, let your eyes flutter open. Okay, so we don't have much to go. But so I want to look at transformation, because this has had all been about the mind and its potential. So we can transform the mind using sutra methods, and you can use it through tantric methods. Most of us are all quite familiar with the sutra, so we're going to focus mainly on that. How is it done? How do we transform the mind through sutra? Primarily through antidotes. You just find the opposite of the thing. And it's as simple as that. What's the opposite of anger and hatred and things? You find it's kindness, acceptance, patience, these things. What is it for when we become jealous? What is it for? You know, we know we find these things and we go, behavior I need to cultivate is not that, but it's opposite. And so that's what we try and do. And you go after, you look at all the faults of this type of mental affliction, and we, like I said, introduce antidotes to it, specific antidotes. That is the short-term solution. It's probably the easiest one to start with. But then you want to move on and actually get to the root of it. It's this self-grasping ignorance. That's the real root of it. So we need to shift. And of course, these disturbing emotions are all coming out of the self-grasping ignorance. And they're all, and these afflictions are all about us, me. They're in no way about trying to protect me by hurting the other, getting the other way, or drawing something about the other into me. So we need to shift our view from sort of a sense of self-focus and move towards compassion and wisdom. In terms of practically applying this really quickly, so when you see something that you find really unpleasant, so if I say, suppose you're at the demonstration recently, and you see plainclothes police or something knocking over a woman and being quite brutal to how he deals with it. You see something like that, most people would get angry if you're in the demonstrated crowd. You just wouldn't want to see that happen, right? So you might want to then attack the policeman. This would be anger. So what could you do really quickly so that didn't, you knew this was coming up, you could feel yourself becoming angry at the policeman? What do you do? Take a breath.
Yeah.
That's right. The first thing is, don't get angry, right? You have to not be angry. You get angry at that policeman, believe me, you'll be having big problems. Right? You don't need that. So take a breath. Then what? From your side, you could, in terms of your mind, you know, so I'm just talking about mental transformation here. Right? You stop the anger immediately by taking the breath. Now what? What's the opposite of anger? And
compassion
and love and kindness, isn't it? They're the opposites. Okay, so what are you going to do?
Situation.
Okay, so how are you going to de-escalate yourself?
Yeah, well, that's right. Recognize that you're feeling angry and, you know, take control of your anger and, like what you said, like you breathe, you see it.
So you,
it's a potentially dangerous situation.
Yeah, so you see all that, and you've got this feeling coming up, and you know I'm getting angry. But I've got this feeling that I want to.
You know that you can't do anything.
But if you do
anything, you're
going to
escalate.
But yes. So what we're saying, I can't do anything. So here I'm trying to get back to you guys, mental training.
Yes.
What are you going to, what training are you going to apply here?
So I wonder if you would have compassion for the policeman because he's in a situation, it may not be his values, but he's at work, so he's doing, so you have compassion for the policeman, you have compassion for the person,
And by that stage, hopefully that person's getting help.
Chris, you want to say something?
Yeah.
So I'm not getting this, but I'm trying to get it from you, which is, imagine, okay, so we're angry. We've felt it, but we know anger is really destructive. It will not be helpful here. So we take a few deep breaths, breathe in. Anger is diminished. You have space. What is the thought? May you be happy. May you be free from suffering. Simple. Love and kindness, compassion. Think it. Run it through your mind. That's the training. Everyone's got all around it, but they haven't applied it. So like anger come up to apply itself pretty quickly, don't it? And we just go, oh, no. So we don't. It. We breathe. We get a gap. We get a space. So we have this thing. Now our love and care for them has to be extended towards them. After that, you do that. Then you can walk up to them and say, is there any way I can help? Are you okay? Things like that, right? But even if you didn't walk up, your mind had changed. You would have kindness and love to the policeman and to the woman who's on the ground. This is what I'm trying to get through to you. But if they're your parents, your mother, then it's, I love you, Mum. I don't want you to hurt. So you say, may you be free of suffering. May you have happiness. Sandy, anyone can say on the same thing? I'm
basically
going to
say, recognizing that people involved are helpless.
Yeah.
With
that's right. Yeah. So we recognize that. But like I said, then there's a response. Right? And so we recognize in their helplessness, compassion arises. We have this, oh man, I wish they were free from suffering and its causes. I wish they had happiness and its causes. That sort of thing. That's basically through the sutra method. Tantra is a little different. The major ways you do the transformation is through what they call abandoning the ordinary view of oneself and adopting what they call a pure view. So from a tantric perspective, you're mainly working with, and like I said, so this is a highly advanced practice, right? The subtle mind, the very subtle mind. All this other stuff was conceptual mind, gross mind. That's how you do it. Now you're looking with a very subtle mind. And of course, that subtle mind is just not mind. It has a body, an energetic body. So we're really looking at what's the energy of anger? What is the energy of all of these delusions? All these delusions have energy. It's not from this perspective. It's all purely enlightened energy. The very subtle mind is not negative. Yeah, it's a completely, and so I was going to say with this new book that Thomas and Tukun Chodron put out, there's a really excellent part in there about what it means to take disturbing emotions onto a path. And believe me, it's not what you think it is. And I was like, oh my gosh, I had no idea. It's so clearly put. So if you do get a chance to have a look at that book, get the index and go through and go, okay, where is this stuff? I'll read about it. The way these guys sort of practice this, I said, abandon the ordinary view. So you adopt the view. Because remember here, in the old ways, we're grasping at a false idea of self, right? That's the root of all the problems. How to overcome that? What do we do? Well, we use the wisdom of emptiness to create a divine appearance, divine identity. And pure appearance. From that perspective, there are no actual disturbing emotions. You're in the pure view. But what you're really working at is energy flow and trying to work with it. And obviously, you break it down inside your divine body. But so in that system, you know, I can't, you know, you start off in isolation. Okay, now try to see yourself as clear as a daisy. So I was doing, like, don't be ordinary here. Wisdom realizing is a wisdom that you can apply that knows you are not the body, you're not the mind, you're not something independent of them. You can know that. That's wisdom, that exists. That wisdom creates, with that wisdom, you create the divine identity. It's a mere imputation, like all things are. I am the deity. And I don't have a body of flesh and blood. I'm a body purely made of light. And in that light body, the way, you know, our biology is set up like this, we're sort of familiar with it. Tantric biology is quite different. It's made up of wheels and chakras and energy systems and all sorts of things. So, and so what you're doing is you're guiding the energy of your emotions into particular places. And what we normally call a disturbing emotion, it dies in there. It's transmuted. So it's called taking the result as the path, taking the enlightened result as the present path. So instead of abandoning delusions, you transform their very energy into wisdom by identifying with the pure Buddha nature. This is like a skilled alchemist, Vajrayana practice does not discard the poison of delusion, but transforms it into the potent medicine of enlightened wisdom. And I said, if you can get that book and go through it, you can say, oh, this is how they're doing it. It's not as simple as they say, take desire onto a path. Yeah. Hang on, we just got rid of all that in the sutra method. What are you talking about? So the essence of the transformation is you change your mind and then you change the world, you change your world. Remember, your mind is not separate from the world. We're finishing up. So passion towards friends churns like water. Hatred towards enemies burns like fire. Through the darkness of ignorance, one forgets what to adopt and what to reject. To abandon one's homeland is the practice of a bodhisattva. What do you think it means? What do you think this line means? To abandon one's homeland is the practice of a bodhisattva.
Get out of your comfort zone.
That's pretty good then. So,
is it to be disciplined? To discipline oneself?
Yes, it requires discipline.
What's renunciation?
Yeah, so the homeland here is the place, the darkness of ignorance. The homeland is where all your delusions are. That's your homeland. Homeland is the place where all the attachments take place, which is your own mind or its mental triggers that does all this. So it doesn't mean like I've got to leave home, go to Chen Rizik, or I need to leave the monastery and go to a cave. The homeland is the place where all these disturbing emotions are taking place. The home is a metaphor for our mental and situational triggers. I've spent too much talking to you and we're already like 10 minutes over, so I'm just going to leave these two. Right. And say to you guys, so hopefully you will remember at least three or four of the causes, right? Three or four of those six causes that have been all six. But always remember, this is the seed. This is a substantial cause that we already carry with us. Wherever we go, we have the potential to be disturbed. That disturbance will not take place unless we meet objects that bring about this disturbance. Right? And that disturbance is still not going to take place until you pay inappropriate attention to the object. Then it's up and running. It requires all of them together. And it's really assisted by friends. Our habits and the other thing as well. But the essence of transformation is just to change your mind. You just have to change your mind. It sounds really simple and easy to say, isn't it? But some of it's not easy to do, so we just don't want to do it. You know, we're so sure we're right.
It's a foreign language. Not a homeland.
Okay. So if you are writing some of the notes online and so forth, these readings are on pages 27 to 28 and 38 to 40. And of course, we've got some material also on pages 74 to 75. So this is Wednesday. When do we come back next week? Is it on the Thursday or the Wednesday?
There's no class next Wednesday.
Oh, okay, okay.
And the following week is the game.
Okay, okay. So, excellent. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, obviously that would go really well with this because it really gets you the sort of it's a nice sort of slow game where you can have an affliction and you just everyone helps you know how to get rid of this affliction. So it's quite nice.
That's the game.
So yeah, yeah.
So next week there's nothing on a Wednesday night, and then the following week is the game.
Thank you, Deb. Thank you. Okay, I hope this is sort of useful to you. You had something to think about. We have to say thank you to our teachers and the Buddha and the lineage of teachers. So we've created some work on this with us, thinking about it and doing our best to apply it when we can. So due to the merit of these virtuous actions, they are quickly attained the state of the Buddha and lead all human beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the Supreme Jewel, our teacher, not yet born the rising man, may that bond have no decline, not increase but from there. As long as flesh remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may our two remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. And for His Holiness' his long life, the wish granted, wish fulfilling jewels, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world, to the incomparably kind, tending that's either single. May all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And lastly, for the quick recognition of it, which shows that reincarnation. In homage, spreading the moving, precious, and complete teachings for exploration and practice, you wore the armor of patience and never discouraged. Incomparable and incredible.